encouraged, not burdened by the history that they create. They know what is expected of them. They are Manchester United.
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of the Fergie Fledglings. I am your host, Colin Dams, joined by Polly Questel. Nathan might join if he gets done running his errands, but there was a miscalculation there, and he is not here at recording time, so we're going to soldier on without him. But I am joined by Polly Questel.
This is an early learning experience for Nathan as to when you are moving with your significant other and she wants to run some errands for your new spot, what kind of scope it's going to undertake.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're excited for this new chapter in his life, and maybe she will learn things about Manchester United in the future just from hearing him podcast, or maybe not. I don't know.
He said that they watched the match together on Saturday. And what did he say? She slept through the whole thing?
Well, I think what he was saying was, like, she was able to sleep through the whole thing because he didn't make any noise until, like, the second half when we scored.
It wasn't a difficult game to sleep through.
No.
It was
the early kickoff, wasn't it?
No, it was 10 o'clock. It was a 10 o'clocker.
Okay.
It just happened to also be one of the more exciting ones we've played this season, which says a lot about this season.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if this was us texting through it or, like, stuff I saw on Twitter, but the talk of it being, like, one of the better Man United performances is not very encouraging.
Here's what I need to know. If you remember the match, the first literally 2 minutes was just United passing it around. Luton didn't get a touch. They got one touch. I think they took the ball off of Garnacho or Reguilon. One of those two, like, lost control of the ball at one point, and it went out for a United throw-in. So for 2 minutes, United did nothing but pass it around. They worked it forward. They worked it back. You know, I think, like, everybody but Højlund got a touch of the ball. And at one point, United finally, like, I think it was Rashford, ran at people, and they won the ball back. And the defender just took a touch and hoofed it all the way down the field. And Luton did such a ferocious job chasing after this long ball that Harry Maguire took his sweet ass time running back to collect it and carrying it forward. That was how hard they chased it. And I immediately said to the people I was standing with, oh, it's going to be one of those games. Luton have no interest in, like, playing or anything. And United really struggled. They did, like, within what, when was that early Højlund chance? Like 5 minutes in?
Yeah, it was like the third minute, I think.
Yeah, so for, like, the second game in a row, they create a really good chance early for Højlund. One time he finished it, one time he didn't. You know, that's sort of going to happen. Not 50%. I think more than 50% he'll finish it. But he's not going to finish them all. And this one he happened to miss, which happens. 10 minutes in. It was 10th minute, so it took 9 minutes. And other than that, they didn't really create anything substantial for the rest of the first half. And then, of course, you go online at halftime, and everybody's talking about how, like, this has been the best United performance in a long time. So what I need to know is, when United face an opponent that just parks themselves in their own end, sits back, plays that low block, that's what Luton did. At 20, 30 minutes, they ventured out a little bit. You were saying at halftime, like, Luton had the best chance of the match, and I had to be like, remember the Højlund one. But otherwise, yes, Luton had the best chance of the match at that point. When a team plays a low block against United and United are struggling, how do we decide whether the discourse is, up, oh, there's United, can't break down a low block, they stink, or, wow, look at all that possession. This is the best United have played in ages.
Well, I think it depends on who's manager, Polly.
I think that's what it is. Because, again, this was not United keeping possession. This was United having all the possession because Luton were giving them the ball back. And United were quite poor at trying to come up with something. Look, their XG at the end of the game ended up very high. It ended up being 2.1. That's very good. 0.75 of that came on that one chance, but that's basically what United have been at their best under Erik ten Hag has been. We create really good chances, but only a few of them per match, and they require a lot of guys getting forward to do so. And so when it doesn't quite work, it's easy to go the other way on them. We've seen that happen a few times with Diogo Dalot being caught out and people not rotating and covering for him, et cetera, especially when Casemiro can't cover that ground. But also when you have and this was a big issue last year too, is when you have a team of inefficient finishers, is it better to create a few really good chances or more good to half chances? Because these are guys that are going to score good to half chances. But even the best finisher is going to miss a really good one. What's now? Like Rasmus Højlund has been on fire from close to goal. It is sort of a fluky thing that all of his goals have come in the Champions League. He's also gotten more chances in the Champions League. In the Premier League, he's not getting as many chances. So like you created a tap-in for him 3 minutes into the game against Copenhagen and he finished it. And you created a almost a tap in for him 10 minutes into this one. He doesn't finish it all the time, but is that the best way to go about things when you have guys that maybe aren't the world-class finishers of Robert Lewandowski or, you know, guys that will miss the really good chances, but they're also going to score they're going to score their fair share of good to half chances. So wouldn't you want more volume?
Yeah, I think this kind of goes to a question throughout the Erik ten Hag, you know, tenure as manager, kind of regarding the wingers and, you know, not necessarily picking a front three that's going to create that volume of chances for whoever the center forward is. I think, you know, last season, they kind of, you know, fed the hot hand in Rashford and they opened up, you know, avenues for him to get forward and score in the best ways that, you know, he's able to do that. This season, it's, you know, you mentioned they maybe have stumbled onto something with playing Rashford on the right, Garnacho on the left, and Højlund through the middle. But, you know, it's November now. And it for the months before that, it really didn't seem like there was much of a coherent front three in terms of, you know, trying to create, you know, find sustainable high volume chances from the wingers, especially, you know, with Antony back in the side. And I think they're still figuring it out, but there are noticeable trends throughout Erik ten Hag's Manchester United tenure of this is not a side that really creates a high volume of chances, you know, for whatever reason.
Are you reading, or have you been reading the draft of the piece that I'm writing? It's still in the drafts. It's not completed yet, but
this
it's literally about that. Of the
this
trends
is, this
of,
is actually
under
from
Erik ten Hag.
Notes I took down yesterday. I was listening to an NFL podcast, but it got me thinking about, you know, Manchester United in general under Erik ten Hag, because there's some attention now to, you know, the form table and how it feels surprising that Manchester United are, you know, one of the better sides on form over the last few matches.
Can we talk about that for a second?
Yeah, we can. That's kind of what I was
leading. Hilarious.
Yeah.
It's hilarious. but I think that needs to be remembered is for this past game, they were playing Luton Town, who are awful. They're actually 18th, not 20th, which is kind of shocking because people pegged them at the beginning of the season to possibly be in the running for Darby County's record of basically the 1962 Mets of ineptitude. They are the form team, but they've also been that's the result. Like I tweeted this a while ago. I want to say, I think it was against Crystal Palace in the League Cup. And people killed me for it, which was ridiculous. But I was like, nobody's faster to forget quality of opponent faster than Manchester United fans. You beat Crystal Palace C team and it's like, oh, we're back.
Yeah.
We beat Luton Town. It's like, look at this dominant performance. You beat we're the form team in the league. And it's, well, hold on a second. Let's look at our schedule. And also let's look at what we've done. Like, we have not done anything crazy since the last international break. You go over the fixtures. Sheffield United, that's a game we should win. And mm-hmm. we did. And that was actually, considering that Sheffield only got through on a penalty, like probably the most thorough win we've had. Then you played Copenhagen at home. You should win that. And they did. Barely. Manchester City, not going to win that. Tough game. And they got destroyed. Newcastle in the League Cup. Tricky fixture. Maybe your cup luck keeps going. It's a home game. You're good at home. Newcastle rotate their side and demolish United. Then you play Fulham. You should win that. And they did. Barely. You play Copenhagen. Copenhagen away. Tricky fixture that they should win, and they don't. And then you play Luton at home. You should win that. And they do.
Yeah.
They have not beaten a team in the top half of the table yet. In fact, now that Brentford have lost, all the teams are currently in the bottom. Brentford are 11th. They are the best team United have beaten. United got thrashed by Burnley. Not Burnley. By Brighton, who then went and beat Bournemouth, who are 17th. And since then have not won in six games.
Yeah, it's like two draws and four losses, something like that.
Yeah, they've lost to Palace and they barely beat Brentford. So, yeah, they're the form team because they've been playing nobody. Remember in September when we were like, this is in the September international break, when we were like, this is bad. And everybody's like, well, their schedule's been tough. Okay, well, you just played the easiest part of your schedule and your results got you got the results you needed. You needed to beat Sheffield, Fulham, and Luton. So you got the 9 points there. It was always going to be tough to beat Manchester City or even get a result there. But the performances, their underlying numbers are not getting better. And the underlying numbers say that United are very mid-table, if that.
Yeah. But
and
it's also
not getting better, and you're about to play better teams.
It's also not dissimilar to last season. Because if you look at the teams at the bottom of the table, it's like 1-0 Southampton, 1-0 Leicester City, 0-0 Southampton, 2-2 Leeds United, 1-1 Crystal Palace. Like this is not uncommon for, you know, in looking for trends in Erik ten Hag's United. And
right. And their two biggest wins last year, or their two best wins, were probably Leicester at home and Chelsea at home. And that the first half of each of those games might have been their two worst halves of the season.
Yeah, they let up some really bad opportunities, especially in the Chelsea game. But so the podcast I was listening to yesterday, they were talking about the Monday Night Football game where the Bills lost. And they're kind of contextualizing the Bills season because, you know, for non-NFL listeners, the Bills are a team that was expected to be very good. They're expected to, you know, compete for the AFC title this year. And instead they're at 5-5 and they look like they're a little bit of a mess right now. And they use the phrase, the curse of supposed to, when looking at the Bills this season, kind of saying they've always been a team that, you know, or Josh Allen has always been a quarterback that is like, you know, high volume chances, also high volume turnovers. We're not really learning anything new about this team. It's just their record that is kind of sticking out. And we've put this curse on them of, you know, they're supposed to be better than this. And that made me think of Manchester United. You know, last year, it feels really positive because, you know, within the context, obviously they finished third. But comparing those results kind of to how they've been so far this year, the only thing that's really changed is our expectations. I mean, they've, you know, undergone a little bit of a makeover in terms of squad, but this is pretty much the same team. Erik ten Hag is, you know, not trying to play the same way as they did for much of last season, but the games that they are winning are not too dissimilar from what they were last year. The problems that they're facing in some of these bigger games where they're losing are not dissimilar from the problems they faced last year.
Yeah, so I think this is actually something I wrote and released a piece about last week. It was something that I've been working on for a year. I started writing this piece in September of 2022 under the guise of, are United building their squad the right way? And then work got in the way, and then the Qatar thing started leaking, and I went, well, maybe if Qatar came in, I don't think so, because I think there's FFP rules to factor in, but like, let's see where this is going. Maybe you get an influx of money and you can actually get around this. So I let that play out a bit. And then it was like, oh, nope, we're back. I started working on it again. Things got in the way. I started working on it again early on in this season. Things got in the way again. And then by the time I got back to it, it was like this whole, it centered around like, should you spend $60 million on Casemiro? Like, why the hell are you doing that? That is a win now signing, and you're supposed to be trying to build for the future. And it was asking a lot of like, well, what if his form falls off the cliff by like September, October? I was like, all right, well, the question is, are you building a squad for the future? The answer is already no. It's been answered. It's no longer me wondering. It's been answered. So this could
be Casemiro the Von Miller of Manchester United.
Yeah, I just saw that tweet. This could be expected, because when you look at United, the average age of United last year, like the average age of the Premier League title winners over the last 6 years was like 26.4 or something. And last year, United's average age was like 26.8 or something. Basically, that is the peak of your team. When your team gets to that age, when your average age is about 26, you got to be like, nah, we got to get younger. That's basically the peak. And if you looked at this team last year and you said, if nothing changes, are they going to be better this year? And the answer was probably not, because you couldn't expect Casemiro to be as good last year. He had an amazing year last year. Marcus Rashford had a career high in goals, 17 Premier League goals. He had over 30 goals. A lot of that came a lot, unbelievable numbers at home, less so away from home. A lot of it counterattacks and everything. And you're like, is he going to repeat this? Yeah, he could score 25 to 30 again in all comps. Not playing in the Europa League anymore, though, going into the Champions League, which he has historically done well in. So we're not going to hold that against him. But is he going to, you know, he's played how many Premier League years? He's never gotten 17 before. So you can expect, you could say maybe he gets 15 to 17 again, but probably not 20 to 21. Certainly not the 40 that Erik ten Hag was going to say. So it was like, where are those goals going to come from? Yeah, maybe you get more from Antony in year two. That, throw that out the window. Without even signing a player like Christian Eriksen, you're going to get less from him. All things Rafael Varane, you got to expect he's going to be whatever. He's going to be a year older, probably injured again, etc. Like so much of this team is at their peak that it was like they're not really going to get much better with natural progression, rather than, whereas like Arsenal's average age was like 24. You can look at that team and be like, Bukayo Saka can still take a step up. Gabriel Martinelli can still take a step up. Like Eddie Nketiah can. A lot of people can. Not that all of them will, but there's a lot of people that can, where it's less likely with United. So, and their underlying numbers last year said that they were not this good. They were sixth best in expected goal difference, which is one of the best metrics in predicting things. It continues to come up correct year after year after year. And this has happened to United before. They were sixth in expected goal difference in 2017-18. They finished with 81 points because David De Gea was Superman. And the next year they crashed. They were fourth in expected goal difference in 2021. But they finished with about 8-ish points more than like all the expected points models had them finishing. And they crashed the following year. And under Erik ten Hag, they finished with, again, like 8-ish points more than the expected points models had them finishing. And where are we a year later? Is not much better. And it was predictable and disappointing because, again, like we talked about it at the beginning of the season, this team needed to improve just to tread water because of the fact they overachieved. And that hasn't happened. Like all of their, it's not just, you said it's the weight of expectations and our expectations. We expect more out of them. And I don't disagree with that. But the underlying numbers have gotten worse, and that should not happen.
Yeah. But I would say definitely in terms of narrative, underlying numbers don't often reflect the way teams are talked about.
For sure not. The mainstream media hasn't really caught up to that. And you're never going to get an accurate picture on Manchester United, especially from like Talk Sport and the call-in shows and whatever, because losing sells, controversy sells. So even the United fan camps are thinking of something to drum up controversy. Oh, we beat Luton Town. Bruno Fernandes is terrible. You got to throw something like that out there to make people get mad at you. To, you know, getting dunked on Twitter for a fan cam is good. And for TalkSport, it's let's drive. So like, you know, they're always United or Cowboys. They're always going to be pumped up by the media, and they're always going to be quick to like tear them apart. You're never going to. Marcus Rashford is Dak Prescott. Right. And there's always a number that could be used to like to spin it. Like Eric Ten Hag is faster to 30 wins or 50 wins than Jurgen Klopp and Mikel Arteta. That's what it is. He has 50 wins now. Is that what it is? Or
yeah, it was the fastest to 50 wins.
And that's the stat that shows, oh, so he's better because year one and two, he's done better. But then
not that we played like 70 games last season.
We played 70 games. We played in the Europa League. Now, granted, Klopp played in the Europa League when he joined Liverpool, and so did Arteta. And then they both missed Europe. So, yeah. Yes. Well, but wasn't it like first whatever most wins in their first 50 games, or something, or was it first 250 wins?
I'm pretty sure it was first to 50 wins.
Okay, so yes, he played. Well, yeah, he played in more.
And the League Cup and the FA Cup run really helped boost that.
Yes, and when you're in the Europa League and the others aren't, you get more games against teams from outside of England, which are significantly worse than you. The other thing is, look at the ages of the squad. Ten Hag's squad is built to win now. And Arteta and Klopp had young squads that they stripped away and made younger. Their strategy was not, it doesn't matter what we do right now. This was the gist of the piece I wrote, was United are never going to build something if they are still so fixated on qualifying for Europe at least every other year. Because that's where the root of everything comes, is that those clauses in those contracts that say, if you don't make Europe 2 years in a row, we pay you less money. And because of that, there's such heavy investment on win now players when they finish outside of Europe that you're just keeping a mediocre horse mediocre. Like I equated it to, like, you're basically that NBA team that finishes sixth every year and occasionally wins a playoff series, but you have no shot at competing. But you're in the playoff. You make the playoffs every year, so your fans can believe, and can have hope, and you get to sell a playoff round. Until you realize that falling out of Europe is not the end of the world. United operate as if they fall out of Europe for 2 years, they're going to be forgotten about. Liverpool, how many years did Liverpool make the Champions League between 2009-10 when they fell out of it? And like 2017, they made it like once. They had that Brendan Rodgers year, and that was it. And Look at them, still the biggest club in the world. Perennial, they're perennial powerhouses. Like, it's okay to bide your time on the outside and then build something and then launch yourself back up. And now Liverpool have blown that team up. They have blown it up and they've rebuilt on the fly. And where are they sitting right now?
You could argue they've done it like. Twice in the last 4 years where they've kind of recognized problems and within a summer fixed them, because
they're second in the league.
Yeah.
It's once you have the foundation, you can rebuild on the fly. You strip away a few pieces here and you put in new pieces here, you give them a year, and then you strip away a few pieces. But you need to build that foundation. And United have never built that foundation to the point that, like, every year it's what's on the list. Oh, we need a center back. We need a central midfielder. We need a striker. Right back will just have to wait because we have two young guys there. And you know what? Even though we have a great left back, we're just going to keep signing new left backs. It's the same positions every damn year because they haven't built this foundation. And when they do go out there and sign the midfielder, it's, well, he's old. So now we need a new one next year. Like, build the foundation and the rest will come.
So let's talk about that a little bit with kind of the changes that are happening. If you're ready to move on, unless you had other points to make.
The last thing I would say is, like, you had touched on it before, but it's the underlying numbers that are deeply concerning. And I know a lot of people are saying it's the injuries, but, like, when you get injured, your underlying numbers don't fall this much. Like, United's, your underlying numbers, your production might fall. Your underlying numbers aren't. United's expected goal difference per 90 has gone down by over half a goal. They were at plus 0.45 last year. They're at minus 0.1 now. That's bad. Compare that to Brighton. Brighton lost their two best players. They lost Moises Caicedo. They lost Alexis McAllister. They lost the goalkeeper, who I think had lost his position, his place in the team, like, halfway through the season, so not as big of a loss. Evan Ferguson hasn't really been playing. Granted, he was like a bench guy last year who started some matches. He hasn't really been playing. Mitoma has been pretty silent this year. I imagine they've had an injury here or there. They went from 0.61 to 0.31. That's a pretty big drop, but, like, they're still very much, like, that's the kind of, they're still good. And that's the kind of drop you expect when you lose key players, not all the way down. So, like, when everybody thinks, oh, we just need Lisandro Martinez and Luke Shaw to come back and fix this, that's not going to do it because it's everything else is still atrocious.
Yeah. I mean, Mason Mount is starting to have an eerily similar season to Jadon Sancho's first season at Man United of just, for whatever reason, he's not playing, even though, you know, his position is a problem area in the starting 11, but we're not really sure what to do with him for, you know, whatever reason. And there's lots of other holes in midfield that we don't have the personnel to fix because Casemiro was supposed to do that and his legs are going the way of Nemanja Matic. And then you've got Scott McTominay, who has moved around to play different positions. I mean, he played number 10 ahead of Bruno Fernandes in one of the games in the past couple of weeks. You know, Bruno Fernandes still hasn't really played his...
Even when Bruno Fernandes is the number 10 defensively, like, in possession, he's the deepest of the midfielders.
Yeah.
And we talked about this a couple of weeks ago where we said they seem to be picking players on individual talent without regarding how they've meshed together, which is why they accidentally stumbled upon this more balanced front three of Garnacho, Hoyland, and Rashford. That's why McTominay is not, like, that's part of the reason why Mason Mount isn't getting into the team, is Mount hides from the ball just as much as McTominay does. He's not getting on the ball a lot. It's bad. Yeah. But McTominay's at least giving you those goals. And because of that, because Erik ten Hag is like, well, nobody else is scoring, so how can I drop him? And, like, McTominay's gotten on the end of a good chance literally every game he's played. So again, you're not creating chances because you don't have creators out there. You're not creating a lot of chances, and there's not so much cohesion, but, like, it's just like, how do you could see how Erik ten Hag is thinking, well, how could I take this guy out? But there was a name you mentioned that's interesting. Ryan O'Hanlon wrote an article, I think yesterday, where he examined, for ESPN, where he examined basically the teams that are doing much better than last year and the teams that have fallen off this past year. You, like, weighted it by their schedule to come up with the number. Nobody has fallen off more than United, and it's not even close. And that's pretty understandable in terms of their underlying numbers. And he said, what's causing this? It's almost always you got a new player. that's causing you to be much better. And if you're much worse, it's, well, someone left. Either someone left or you're missing a player. And he's like, who's missing from this United team? So now you can name a laundry list of people. But in terms of the percentage of minutes they played last year compared to the percentage of minutes they've played this year, who do you think the two players with the biggest discrepancy is?
You said for minutes?
Percentage of available minutes last year and percentage of available minutes this year. Who's got the biggest discrepancy? The two players. One of them's easy.
Is it Jadon Sancho?
That's the hard one. Sancho, by far and away. So, like, you would think it's Rafael Varane, or you would think it's Lisandro Martinez. It's not. Lisandro Martinez played 61% of Premier League minutes last year. That's barely over half.
Well, he Varane
played 50. He got hurt. Varane played 56. That's even less. Also got hurt. But like, it just shows they were not ever present in the team. Like, you know, you almost had a coin flip. If you turned up to any random game at Old Trafford, you had basically a coin flip of seeing one of those guys in the team. So the two guys are Luke Shaw and Jadon Sancho. Those are the two guys missing. And Sancho actually played 49.33% of the minutes last year. So he played half the season, even though he was gone for a few months. He played half the season. And on a team that struggled for goals and struggles for creativity, they play so close to the margins. Even someone who is not outwardly having a great season, like Sancho was, like, when you're doing all those other little things that he did, can go and make a huge difference. And like, remember, he started the season out very well.
He was never on the pitch when the narrative was about him as a failure. You know, like, he spent that period away from the team. And other than that, when things were like going bad for him, he was just dropped. He was never like actually playing atrociously on the pitch. It was just a case.
Right. It was just like
whether
wait,
he was
going to
pop up with a moment
this,
or not.
Yeah. And this guy's supposed to be this explosive player who, you know, a goal contribution every game, because that's what he was doing at Borussia Dortmund. And he wasn't. And like, you know, yeah. Granted, he was taking like 2 to 3 shots a game at Dortmund. He was taking like half a shot a game at United in both of his full seasons, which was, I can't explain that. And that's definitely bad. That's not what you want to see. But all the other things that he's doing, like, and he started the season out well. He scored against Liverpool. He either scored or got an assist on the goal against Leicester. He finished the season well. The end of the season, everybody was talking about him really turning a corner and looking good for next year. He started the FA Cup final, and everybody was like, yeah, he should be starting the FA Cup final. And then he went into preseason where he was good.
He scored at MetLife.
Yeah, and he scored another. That was like his second goal of preseason. He was probably one of their better players in preseason. I'm like, look, preseason doesn't mean anything, but also like, in a team that didn't dominate preseason and got off to a rough start, like, it's weird that you take the one player who was playing well and say, you're done here.
Which is why there's probably more that we have not heard about.
There's more that we have not known. There was a report today that basically said United's senior staff at United, as well as his teammates, have begged him to apologize, and he is still steadfastly refusing, which means there is so much more to the story, because this is,
and like,
personal.
I think that's indicative that like other people don't really have a problem with him or what he,
yeah,
you know, it seems like they just want this to be resolved, which I'm sure.
I think, it shows you his teammates don't have a problem and they want him in the team. And the senior staff people, I would think, are like, we have a huge investment in you and we got to pay you no matter what. And if you are, unlike, you're not, you, if you don't want to leave, you don't have to leave. We can't make you unless we pay you. Like, and therefore, and if we pay you, like, that's money that can't go to somebody else. So basically, we need you to work and we need you to do everything possible. But he feels that he's been slighted. I think if Eric Ten Hag were to go to apologize to him, he would apologize back. I think it's both of them. Like, they both feel that they're in the right and that the other one is in the wrong. And they both want the other one to apologize, and they're both stubborn. And he's got power here. They've got to pay him. And
yeah,
the team is struggling. And look, like I said, when you're playing this close to the margins, the little things that he's doing may have made a difference last year, and United may be lacking that this year.
And it's like, it's easier to replace a head coach and a GM than it is to replace the quarterback you just paid.
Right. Like, which is why he probably feels like, I'm going to outlive Eric Ten Hag, which I said right away. But think about this. How many shots do you think Rashford, Bruno, Antony, and Garnacho have set up for Haaland this season?
For Haaland or Hoyland?
For Hoyland. I apologize.
They might have set up more for Haaland than...
Yeah, they might have.
Combined,
take a guess.
Three.
Oh, you've got the amount that Rashford has. It's eight in the league. Eight in the league and combined three in the Champions League. All of them from Rashford. Your forwards aren't finding your striker that you signed, which is part of why your striker isn't scoring.
Your striker wasn't playing until a month into the season, though. I mean, if they'd had him, if they'd gotten Hoyland in at like June, do you think that would have been different?
No, because Antony's not that kind of creator, and neither is Garnacho. Rashford on the left wing isn't that kind of creator. Rashford has created seven shots for him in the league and Champions League. Two of them have been while he's been playing on the right wing, which is much more limited minutes. That's just not the kind of players that they are. You kind of need a creative winger. Like, Rashford on the left wing, Antony on the right wing, Garnacho on the left wing are all cut into the middle and shoot players. Like, that's what we're saying, like, why you lack something when you play McTominay up there, because your central guy is only Bruno, and McTominay is not going to be able to carry that burden. That's why you brought in a player like Mount, is you need someone else to be able to find your striker, and they can't do that.
Yeah. What are the chances that you think we top last season's goal difference?
What was our goal difference last season?
15. Very much boosted by the final four games, four or five.
But our goal difference right now is minus four. Minus three.
Okay.
See, here's the thing is, I mean, they United have only conceded, they've only conceded six goals, four non-penalty goals in their last seven games. Two of the non-penalty, three total, have come against Manchester City, where you can expect that's going to, you know, inflate the total. So they have started keeping the ball out of the net. Granted, not so much outside of the league. It does coincide with Harry Maguire coming into the team and the line, they're defensive and holding a much higher line. When Maguire plays, the line's been 3 meters higher on average. In the Ten Hag era, it's like actually much greater this season, but overall in the last 2 years, 3 meters on average. So they keep the ball out of their own box more, which helps reduce the amount of shots, the amount of the XG, and the amount of goals they're conceding. Is that a byproduct recently of the fact that they've been playing Sheffield and Fulham and Luton and crap teams? Also, probably. So maybe in this next stretch, they might, you know,
there's a start very good chance Liverpool beats us 7-0 again. I mean,
there is, yeah.
In a stretch of five games,
City like got their big win last year. They never seemed like they needed a big win this year. I think Liverpool would without question. Maybe they do what they did at Old Trafford and be like, all right, 5-0's enough and take their foot off the gas. But I think they would. Look, Darwin Nunez ain't passing up a chance. Like, if he's got a chance to score,
nah.
If it's 6-0 and he's got a chance to score.
You give him 5 yards in the final third, it doesn't matter where he is.
Yeah. And Mo Salah, like, I think he revels in scoring against United. So, you know, they're up 8-0. He's got a chance.
It's clear as much as Klopp, like, will downplay the like rivalry or whatever at some points, it's very clear he loves winning these matches. By
yes,
possible.
He understands what they mean.
Yeah, he's smart.
and he's
tapped into the Liverpool fan base. I mean,
right. And he's also smart in that it's like, do it on the pitch. Like, there's no reason for this Jose Mourinho mind game stuff. Like, no reason to take this into the media and take it into the press conference and make that the story of the game, where he's just like, let it be Manchester United versus Liverpool and let us just go out there and beat them. Don't give them bulletin board material. Don't make the story something about that. While we're worried about Liverpool on December 17th, be more worried about Newcastle on December 2nd.
Also Chelsea. I mean, they're finishing the chances that they whiffed on last year.
Chelsea. Let's talk about Chelsea for a second.
Okay.
Chelsea were quick to be disregarded, and I disregarded them too. I thought Chelsea would be better because it was impossible to be worse, but I did say they are not going to score. Like, I don't know where their goals are going to come from. Let's remember something about Chelsea. They were good under Thomas Tuchel last year for 6 games. Then they were good under Graham Potter, but results just didn't go their way. He brought that brightness to them where they created a lot of chances and they didn't finish them, but they didn't concede a lot of chances, but like had some bad luck and they couldn't get wins. And then they were LOL under Frank Lampard. And they not only have gone back to just not just competent under Mauricio Pochettino, they're good. They're fourth in expected goal difference. It's just results aren't going their way. And I said this at the beginning of the season, is who's going to score the goals for them. And if Nicholas Jackson starts scoring with any kind of regularity, they are going to be a problem. At the start of this, I remember it. Not this international break, but I think the international break beforehand, or maybe it was the first international break of the season. I was like, oh, Chelsea's numbers are pretty damn good. And they're trending towards like, you'd rather be Chelsea than United. Everybody came back at me being like, well, they played the easiest schedule. United played a hard schedule. And it's like, okay, well now Chelsea have played a harder schedule. They're undefeated against the top 6 teams that they've played so far. United have played the easiest part of their schedule. United's numbers are not getting better. Chelsea's numbers are not getting worse. And that's the thing about these underlying numbers. They tend to stay this way. Like at the beginning, yes, there's some extremeness because you have a good game in your first, you have an amazing game in your first 4 games. It's going to skew them. But after 10 games, they kind of stick around like this. And there's a lot of problems. So, yeah, you're right. Chelsea's a problem. And Newcastle. We play Newcastle and then Chelsea, right?
Newcastle, Chelsea, Bournemouth, Bayern Munich, Liverpool.
And at the end of the month, we have West Ham and Aston Villa. Those are two teams that beat us last year. I don't know if they're home or away, but like those are we have to play all the teams in
Tottenham. Well, that's in mid-January. So, the schedule hasn't.
We have to play all these top half of the. We have to play all these teams in the top half of the table, and we haven't beaten anybody in the top half of the table. Like, remember when we finished on 75 points last year? We wanted to improve on that. In order to improve on that, you need to replicate what you did and then flip some draws and losses into wins. And I always said
those draws are flipping into losses.
Yeah, but I always said, like, replicating all those wins is not going to be easy. You are not winning against Arsenal, City, Chelsea, Tottenham, and City. And you're not beating the top 6 at home. You're not going 5-5 at home again. And they haven't. And like, if you look at the corresponding fixtures from last year, they have not reversed any of them in a good way. They beat Crystal Palace at home. Now they've lost the Crystal Palace at home. They drew Tottenham away. Now they've lost the Tottenham away. They beat City at home. Now they've lost to City at home. They lost to Brighton at home. They lost to Brighton at home again. They're not reversing anything. And I don't mean to be all doom and gloom, and say that, oh, it's impossible for them to turn it around. And you know, Luke Shaw coming back isn't going to help anything. Luke Shaw coming back is going to help tremendously. At a certain point, Rashford will find himself. At a certain point, Rasmus Højlund is going to score goals. Can they turn it around? Absolutely. It's just that the chances of it are slim, and it's like, manage your expectations. If you're expecting this to happen because Erik ten Hag is the greatest person and he should be fully trusted and we are Manchester United and it's the name, you're setting yourself up for disappointment. If that's how you want to live, I'm not going to tell you not to. I'm not going to yuck somebody's yum. I'm just telling you, like, if you set reasonable expectations so you don't have to become so mad and so upset.
All the outside factors. Yeah. But kind of going back to what you were saying about how we overachieved a bit last year, it really doesn't help us this year that the rest of the Premier League is kind of getting better. You know, not just Aston Villa kind of continuing good form, Tottenham, potentially Chelsea, Liverpool, Newcastle staying on their trajectory. You know, that makes the European picture a lot more crowded and a lot more difficult to play catch up, which United are going to have to do regardless of, you know, other teams' form. So I think this winter fixture, you know, particularly the beginning of it, is going to have a lasting impact on the way we view Erik ten Hag.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting because it's not just those teams that got back. Like, yeah, West Ham bounced back. West Ham were a team that their numbers were way better than where they were last year, and they won the Conference League. Not gonna say easily, but they were favored pretty much every step of the way, and they took care of business in those games. They were never they never should have even been close to the relegation zone. They just were, results weren't going their way. So them bouncing back, not surprising. What I was surprised when I said, you know, what I think might actually, and this will hurt United, is your three promoted teams are freaking bad. I was saying this at the beginning of the year, was Everton are terrible and they should go down, and Wolves are terrible and they should go down. And they will probably be fine because Bournemouth, who are the newly pro? Because Luton, Sheffield United, and Burnley are so atrocious. And sometimes that's all it takes. Like, Everton 100% should have been relegated last year. And if just anything happened, like, it was like, if you get any kind of decent team this year, they should have went down again. But sometimes all it is you get that one point and next year, instead of being in the relegation zone, you're just 15th, not in the relegation zone and not in the battle, and you climb back out of that rut. Sometimes that's all it takes. But those teams are so bad that they're not taking points off anybody. So whereas it used to be like, yeah, your relegation teams are the worst, but like, they'll trip up a Brighton, and they're going to trip up a Newcastle, and Spurs are going to drop points to one of those teams. And you know, think about that first year that we had Sheffield and their overlapping center backs, where they took everybody by storm in the first half of the season, and they got points off of us, and we weren't the only top. I think they got points off of a bunch of good teams that year. You're not getting that this year. Everybody's just taking 3 points off them. That it's inflating the top of the table. Where if you're not getting points, you're creating a big task for yourself to do.
We're not actually that far behind the top four. It's just like,
but again, look at like what we just played.
Yeah,
the bottom.
Exactly.
In our last stretch, we played two of those relegation teams, and we played the team that's 16th.
Yeah.
Whereas, you got a lot of teams at the top. Who, you know, Tottenham just played Chelsea. Who else did they play? All these teams
they
at the
lost
top
again
are playing
this weekend, didn't they?
They lost to Wolves. They basically, it evens out with the Sheffield United game where they scored twice in injury time.
I mean, I think we've seen enough from them to know that they're not gonna like just fade away immediately. But we've also seen enough from, you know, Liverpool and Arsenal that they're probably pushing for the title. It could be a three-horse race into March and April, and that leaves one Champions League spot.
Yeah. City just played Arsenal, Brighton, United, Bournemouth, Chelsea. And then their next two games are Liverpool and Tottenham. Like Chelsea just played Arsenal, Brentford, Tottenham, City. Arsenal played City, Chelsea, Sheffield United, Newcastle, Burnley. So you got a lot of teams at the top that were playing each other, whereas United just played City and a bunch of, you know, City came in between playing Burnley, Palace, Brentford, Sheffield United, Fulham, and Luton. And in December, when they start playing top of the table teams again, it could go differently. Now, don't get me wrong. They put themselves in a great position where, hey, if they turn around and win these games, they could leapfrog teams really quickly. You got a bunch of six-pointers coming up. So if you win, you're right. You're not just – you're very in the thick of things. But if form from the last – from the entire Erik ten Hag era continues, you're not going to win, and suddenly you're back down in 10th.
Yeah. So really quick before we end, let's talk about this executive news. Richard Arnold steps down. And there is an interim Patrick Stewart who is not.
Steps. Let's make sure that we put steps in air quotes.
Yeah. But this is not the cool Patrick Stewart. This is Man United legal counsel Patrick Stewart.
Just as bald. We're really committing to the
just bit. As bald. Pauly, there wasn't even a photo of him in our SB Nation database. Like, and you know, we access like, you know, some of the bigger publications for photos like Getty and whatnot. There is not
but a that's photo kind of the thing with United executives. Well, first of all, why would there be a photo of like United's chief legal counsel?
Yeah, that's fair.
If there was, that would kind of be an issue with the club again of being like, why do we know who all these dumb, you know, we shouldn't know who all these people are. We should only know the football people. But that's kind of been the thing when like Murtaugh took over and Richard Arnold took over was there are no photos of these guys. But
well, I mean, there's photos of Arnold going back to like 2013, but like he's been in charge of MUTV. So there's a little bit more visibility with him than there was with like,
look, they're making their head lawyer, the interim like CEO, like there shouldn't be photos out of him. They are very strongly committing to the bald bit though.
Yeah. We could just choose to believe that it's actually Patrick Stewart and there's not going to be much difference because I expect this guy to be on the job for what, 2-3 weeks before this thing is finalized.
I've heard it'll take like weeks for these things move slowly. We're just in the football world where everybody wants it to happen tomorrow. Like I read something today that was just like, like once they announce it, it's still 4 weeks before they can do anything. And even from there, you know, again, there's reports today, like United are already ready to sign somebody in January. It's like, no, they're not. That's not how it works. That doesn't happen.
Yeah.
Ineos is ready to do this. Like Ineos, you mean the people that run their business well, they know that the worst thing they could do is just rashly sign, like go and do something. They're the ones that are going to want to like sit and take time to assess everything and be like, yeah, like let this play out.
Yeah. But we do know.
It's nice that like Richard Arnold is gone because Richard Arnold should have been gone in September.
Yeah.
And
for non-football.
Yeah. I mean, look, say what you want about his. He oversaw change in that, you know, he oversaw change. Did he like the idea was the idea was Murtaugh's going to run the football side of things. And we're going to have this structure. And then Murtaugh went out and hired a coach who said, I'm not working for you unless you give me full control over everything. And Murtaugh said, sure. So you tried to make change and the guy that you hired to make the change relented and just said, nah, status quo. But the way that you handled all these off the field issues, you should have been gone a long time ago.
Yeah. The good news is, though, we probably know who is going to be the not interim guy once Ineos comes in, because Ineos hired Jean-Claude Blanc to kind of oversee their sporting department. And we don't know, you know, a ton about him as, you know, a football executive. He was in charge of Juventus for 4 years from basically the point that they were punished for Calciopoli. He came in like 2007, 2008, 2009, that era. And then I think he left in 2012. So kind of laid the foundation for that first Antonio Conte team. But most of what he does is kind of upper level management. I think he worked in like Tour de France. He was one of the like marketing executive advisors for Paris Saint-Germain for the last few years. So he's not director of football guy. He is manage money and investments guy. And he joined
Ineos. Isn't he going to be like the CEO?
Yes.
Yeah. So like you're replacing Jean-Luc Picard with
Jean-Claude something. Yeah. There we go. That's good.
I thought it was weird that like when I read the news this morning, my first thought was Jean-Luc Picard and not Professor X. I'm like, I don't even watch Star Trek.
Right. But you know, they're basically the same kind of vibe. They're like more
right. But I thought Jean-Luc Picard was old. And then like he's only gone on to have like a career for like 30 more years.
Yeah. Well, that was the thing. Like, I mean, Patrick Stewart's always looked like that pretty much. Like he started to get more wrinkles in the past decade or so, but he's always just kind of looked like oldish.
Right. I was like, oh yeah, you're playing a guy in a wheelchair in X-Men because like you're really old, but like it's still been 25 years since that.
It's like he hasn't been able to walk since he was like 20. Yeah, so at least we kind of know a little bit more of what the, I don't want to say what the changes are, because obviously there's still, you know, speculation about how much will actually change. But in terms of what the structure was agreed upon between Jim Ratcliffe and, you know, the conditions for him coming in, it's kind of positive to see that, you know, that wasn't bullshit.
Yeah. I think everybody's excited. There's good reason to be excited about it. Now, again, yeah.
That's something that's, this is like a payoff in 5 to 10 years sort of move, but
right. It's not to rain on your parade, but everybody's like, oh good, we'll get this guy in by January, so we're ready to go by the summer. And it's like, no, we'll be ready to go by like 2025.
Man,
and that's the kind of patience that hopefully the fans will never have it and the fans will never accept it. But that is the kind of patience that hopefully the people calling the shots have.
Yeah. I got a Bleacher Report notification that was like, you know, 5 signings in January that can help United right now. Like, we are not. It's like,
we don't have money. We didn't have money. We're not signing. We didn't have money to sign Sergio Reguilon. Like, we literally had to like balk at Cucurella because of that extra million that would be in place if he stayed past January. We didn't have money to sign Sofyan Amrabat permanently, though the club didn't want to do that. Erik ten Hag did. Club looking pretty right about that one, as they are about Rasmus Højlund, as they are about hey, we shouldn't have let you make all these choices. The one conflicting thing I've got now is like, I guess If Erik ten Hag says that Donny van de Beek isn't good, then I guess he is. That's the one where I don't know what to believe, because I have eyes too, and I'm like, yeah, he ain't good, but like neither is Antony.
Yeah. Well, hey, even a broken clock is right twice a day, right?
Right.
Yeah. All right. That's gonna do it for us today. We will be back probably in 2 weeks because it's the international break this weekend. I don't imagine we're going to have a whole lot to talk about next week. Plus it's Thanksgiving. So
Colin will tell you we'll be back Monday, and then on Monday he'll text us and be like, I can't do it tonight.
Yeah.
and the rest of the week is Thanksgiving. But I have a piece and I'm going to finish it by early next week. And Colin's going to post it before Tuesday.
Yes.
My challenge towards him, and it is about a lot of the things that we talked about, these trends under Erik ten Hag and what we've got to fix.
Yes. And I might be writing something on the Man United women's team, but I don't know yet.
Well, that word might gonna do a lot of lifting.
Yeah, well, they play Man City this weekend, and that's really the test of like, are we actually still good or not? So
right. you know what's gonna happen next week is like you're gonna sit down to write it and like Monday morning will come and Thanksgiving is gonna hit you and you're just gonna be like, oh, it's an international break and it's Thanksgiving.
Sure.
And you're gonna be
I don't
like,
want to do
out.
Anything.
Exactly.
Yeah. So
have a happy Thanksgiving for everybody that celebrates. If you don't, eat a little bit more next Thursday and then go crazy shopping for Black Friday because somehow that's a thing in the UK, even though there's no Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Well, we'll see you in 2 weeks or whatever.